and welcome to 251. In this situation, two pianists, five questions, one interviewee. Today we're talking to Chris Hodgkins, who has many roles in jazz over the years, and we're looking forward to investigating those. My name's Simon Whiteside.
My name's Nick Tomlin. So, hi Chris.
Hello Nick.
Thanks very much for agreeing to do this little chat with us. So I just thought maybe to begin with you could give a sort of quite brief account of how you got involved in jazz. Obviously you're a musician as well, but also you know, how you became a kind of facilitator as well. Just a kind of brief overview.
Yeah, my brother was a jazz trumpet player. So I was always immersed in jazz from the age of, well, whenever I can remember. And I got about the age of 13 or 14. And I sort of started listening to Louis Armstrong. Mm. And then I guess the bug gets you, you know. Mm. And then when I heard Potato Head Blues, that was it. That was the sort of the blinding flash, the big moment. Mm. And I never looked back. And then my brother said, "Well, he started collecting records and listening to it. Why don't you play?" So we went to a second-hand shop and he bought me a trumpet. So I started. I got some lessons and I just started playing. And then I joined a band when I was 17. Mm. And it went on from there. So I started playing the music of New Orleans. Started listening to classic jazz, all the usual stuff: King Oliver, Louis Russell, Henry Red Allen, and of course General Morton. And then I sort of took a step back and looked back over my shoulder to the music of Bum Johnson, George Lewis, and started playing that. And I guess the great thing about that music is at least it one, it swings, and two, it teaches you how to hold a tune. Mm. But it was a bit like a hair shirt, because there was one occasion when I got taken to see Kenny Ball by the clarinet player, and there was a band meeting the following week, and I was chastised roundly for going to hear a commercial band. So that's what it was like.
Yeah,
it's sort of 1966, 67. So it was a great time. And then I just, did the usual thing of anyone else swam into the mainstream. I heard then Henry Red Allen's Feeling Good album, which is absolutely another album that floored me. Mm. And then I got in the music of Roy Orridge, Buck Clayton, Sweet Edison, Basie Ellington, and Ruby Braff, and went on from there, and then into the music of Chet Baker.
Mm. So it's interesting, so you sort of almost went chronologically through from listening to the sort of...
Well, I was sort of a methodical sort of person, so I sort of did the obvious. But it doesn't matter, Eddie Harvey used to say you could start learning bebop and then go back. It's just, for me, it was just a sort of, and I guess at that time it was that logical, that there were sort of clear logical steps.
It's interesting.
Now it's not so.
I think a lot of musicians kind of, I mean, speaking personally, I sort of went backwards rather than forwards, but it's interesting that you did it that way, really.
Well, I think there was probably quite a lot of that trad revival going on around the 60s, wasn't there?
It was, and it's sort of I don't like the word trad actually, because it was actually the music of New Orleans. And of course, people like Barry Martin were recording a lot of, and bringing over people like Captain John Handy and Kitschik Kola. And there was also a very good trumpet player, young Clive Wilson, who eventually emigrated and now still lives and plays in New Orleans. But that was that sort of. I don't like the word trad, I don't know what you call it, you know, but it was a sort of, some people used to say it was a bowdlerized version of New Orleans music. I don't actually hold that, I think it was just some very good musicians who actually...
interpreting that music.
Who just approached it in a different way, and not in a British way. I mean, Kenny Ball was a fantastic trumpet player, school musician, worked with Sid Phillips and people like that, could read anything. So I think it's, and funny enough, Kenny Ball's favourite trumpet player was Clifford Brown. So it's all never quite,
I suppose what I mean is that there were opportunities to play that type of music
Absolutely.
From that era, less so probably bebop.
Well, you could. The band I joined was playing in a pub two nights a week. Mm. There's always plenty of places to play, and there was an audience for it. I mean, the demographics were right.
Mm.
Those demographics have now slipped away.
Mm.
People have got old, and it's in a sense become nostalgia music, just like the Glenn Miller stuff.
Mm.
Nothing wrong with that. That's the way life goes, you know.
Mm.
So, but it was, and we also used to play in a pub called the Quebec Hotel, which is that one of expression on the wrong side of the tracks. It was in Tiger Bay. So it attracted a lot of students, a big student population. So the place was packed with people had heard jazz in the 50s and had come back out to hear it again. And then a whole new young audience of students. So it's quite a good, and the pub was always absolutely rammed, you know. Doesn't happen these days, I don't think.
No.
Well, it actually does in other places. You know, you look at the young players now, steam down over in Deptford and places like that. Mm. So
it's just different. It's a different.
It's different. Scene, different sort of music. Yeah, different take on things and different. Everyone. You know, as John Fordham always says, people appropriate other music. And you know, Dizzy appropriated Cuban stuff, and Stan Getz obviously South American and Brazilian stuff. So it's interesting in that sense. They've appropriated another whole. Arsenal, if you like, of musics.
Sure.
It's all jazz, it's all improvised, all goes off like the clappers, you know. And the intensity is fantastic. So the whole thing just, music always reinvents itself, you know. It's not administrators that do that, it's actually musicians themselves, you know. That's the great thing about jazz, it always pushes, it's got its own momentum.
Yeah, that's interesting, yeah. And so that's how you became interested in jazz and started as a player. And I mean, what about sort of, were you always kind of involved in organising sort of gigs? And or I just wondered how you got into that side of it.
Interesting. It's just when I left school, I did huge all sorts of jobs, swept the roads, you name it, I did it. You know, once worked for OIA services, printing legal documents and bills of quantity. I mean, good grief. That's probably why I sort of joined the Labour Party. If you've ever done that for a living, it's pretty grim, you know. And also unpleasant, you know, it was a sort of culture of, I can remember going one day, I was doing gigs and things. Worked overtime all weekend, got there on a Monday morning at 9:01, and the foreman looked at me and tapped his watch. And you couldn't make it up, really, could you? It's sort of like grab grind on mescaline, So I did all that, and then you know, as more and more income came in, I then got a part-time job in a marketing company, which is extremely good because it taught me a lot. And I guess it must have been about 74, I suddenly thought, all right, we need something to, a jazz festival to, in Cardiff to pull stuff all together, a lot of, you know. And that was mainly, I mean, the original idea was to actually promote myself, because then you end up promoting everyone else. So there's nothing wrong with that either. So the whole thing grew. And that allowed me to get on a learning curve for organisation, administration.
So this was Cardiff Jazz Festival?
That became the Welsh Jazz Festival.
Okay.
And then I moved to play pro in London in 1980, and a great friend of mine and colleague, Jed Williams, took over the Welsh Jazz Society, which had also formed. That was another route into admin. And the Welsh Jazz Festival sort of transformed itself into the Brecon Jazz Festival.
Okay.
So, and then Jed ran that for many years until unfortunately passed away. So it's interesting. So you end up becoming a musician, and then you end up becoming a band leader, and then you end up becoming a fixer, and then you end up becoming an organizer, and then you organize projects.
I suppose it just keeps growing, and
the whole thing just keeps going on and on and on.
Snowballing. But
That probably leads us well on to our second question,
yeah.
Which is the organisation Jazz Services is remembered fondly by many musicians and people who benefited from the support and advocacy it provided. So how did your involvement start with Jazz Services?
Well, I moved up to London to play pro, and I did that for 3 years. And that would be about 83, so I was then 33. Now, I never had a further education. And things started to irritate me. You read the Financial Times, I couldn't understand the financials. Reading economist commentary, couldn't quite grasp it. So I tried a few teach yourself books, a waste of time. And I'm actually one of those people that teach yourself books are just hopeless. I actually need a teacher throwing bits of chalk at me and could do better and all that sort of stuff. So I went and it sort of really started to bug me. Don't know why, I kept just one of those things that started to irritate me no end. So I went and did Higher National Diploma in Business Studies at Ealing College and spent a fantastic 2 years and managed to had to work like stink. I thought, no one's going to employ a jazz trumpet player with a third-rate qualification in a Higher National Diploma. It's just one look and they'll walk away. So I had to get a distinction. So I remember just working like stink, seven days a week. Then I got it. And then this job at Jazz Services came up, and I'd also been offered a job as a cost of management accountant, trainee, where they were going to pay all my, money wouldn't have been good, but they'd have paid all my professional fees for training. And I thought, well, you know, cost of management accountant, it's extremely well paid, it'll carry a pension, company or private, doesn't matter. Or I also got the job at Jazz Services. And I remember talking to a great friend of mine, John Ferguson, who's since passed on now, a wonderful bass player. And I saw John on the Saturday after my interview at Jazz Services. And he said, we used to call him the Laird, by the way, that was his nickname. He said, look, laddie, he said, you're a bit tall, what's up with you? I said, well, I've got these two jobs. So I explained everything. He said, well, he said, take the job at Jazz Services. It's, as far as we're concerned, it's better the devil we know than the devil we don't know. So I took the job at Jazz Services, obviously because of my interest in jazz. And it started from there, and then in 88 I went and did a part-time MBA, paid for that myself, to give me the strategic knowledge, further knowledge. And so it went on, and it was great. I was there for about 29 years, had a fairly good time. Managed to retire compos mentis in 2014 and just went back to playing and projects and touring and doing two radio programs, digital online stuff. So because one of my neighbours said to me after I retired, oh, I suppose you're enjoying yourself and you're pottering around in your garden and you know, all this sort of stuff. I said, you're joking. I said it's the same. It's the same old grind. It's just a different grindstone. So no, I think we had I thoroughly enjoyed myself at Jazz Services. Had a very good support from the board and also the musicians and the promoters and the jazz constituency. And there were always tussles with the Arts Council about funding and funding in general, and that'll run and run.
I mean, I think you know I'm of that generation really who benefited from Jazz Services, and I think what was so great about it was that, and we really miss it, I think because it was this kind of, it was an organisation between the musicians and the Arts Council, and it was run by people who, like yourself, who understood the jazz scene and understood how the jazz scene works, and I think that was what's, for me anyway, that was what was so so great about it, you know, and it really provided that sort of it was between the Arts Council and the musicians. That's the way I saw it, in a way.
Yeah, but it was very, very kind of you. And it was also, we had some great staff, you know, Celia Wood.
Yes,
did all the information stuff. And we had then Joe Pace, who came in later. And it was, yeah, I suppose it was also that we were also, one of the big things was to be actually even-handed. that to me was the most crucial thing. Mm. And I also understood musicians, not from a funding point of view, actually being on a bandstand.
No, that's I think that's what's so important in a way.
And I've also promoted, so I understood.
Yeah, sure.
The promotion and so forth. So I was, in that sense, fortunate to understand both, if you like, both sides of the coin.
Mm.
And I hope we did what we. Was okay. Celia, thanks to Celia, there's a huge information database.
Mm.
I mean, it's I just no point in looking back. You know, I just always roll the punches and move on.
Mm.
I guess what people do miss is a resource that allows them, for example, to not to duplicate in terms of getting media contacts.
Yeah, yeah.
And in terms of promoters.
Yeah.
I can remember one person saying to me, when I was about to retire, and they said, "Yeah, well, you don't need all this information database now. It's all on Google." So I said, "Fine, okay, Google jazz promoters."
Yeah, sure. Mm, yeah.
And what came up? I think one that was a huge hall that most musicians would never get a gig in there. You know.
Yeah.
I said,
sure.
You know,
yeah, and in fact, I think you probably need it more. The more, because the like you say, there's been an explosion of kind of information, and you need an element where you know it's kind of curated to an extent, I guess, or sort of organised at least.
Well, that's what Celia did. She always reminded me of Boswell when he was writing The Life of Johnson, and noting conversations down and times and dates and so on.
Mm.
And Celia was like, if you like, the Boswell of jazz services. That term, all that data that was there was never pulled out of a hat. It was assiduously gathered, if you like, harvested and so forth.
Yeah.
And it was, of course, it was always out of like, and if like a telephone directory, you're always out of date because someone passes on, people change. And so on. So I can't remember what the ratio would be, but there'd be a ratio of maybe 5% or something that would be out of date.
Mm.
So it always had to be refreshed.
Yes, sure.
But it came in the jazz services handbook came in a binder, didn't it?
Yes, so I remember that. Yes,
you could replace the pages when, with the updates.
That's right. Yeah,
it was a great idea.
Yeah, it was. That was Celia. I mean, she did all that. Of course, things have moved on. Now it's, you'd have a different sort of database, and you would have it so it, hopefully it might self-generate with people actually correcting. It's a bit like Wikipedia, you would take the photo like that. So it was, you know, but there's no point in looking back. It's gone, and it's looking to the future.
Mm.
So I'm involved with the Parliamentary Jazz Group in writing a review of jazz. It takes some time because there's just me, so it's...
So that's going on at the moment, is it?
I'm just writing the actual review. I wrote a paper called Cold Comfort and Home Truths that's available on the AppJag website. And that informed the review, and I'm now analysing all the questionnaires. And what the review will be an action plan, what they call a SWOT analysis.
Mm-hmm.
And then, if you like, what they call PESTEL, which is the wider picture, economics, socio-political, that sort of stuff.
Actually, it might be useful for people listening to this. Could you explain what a SWOT analysis, what they stand for?
That's the problem with probably doing 5 years of business training. These acronyms is all they put their poor nuts to me, but anyone else think, what's SWOT? Is that a fly? You know, SWOT is strengths, weaknesses, opportunities and threats. So if you're a band, you have strengths, and you obviously have weaknesses. You're only as good as some of the parts.
Mm.
There are also opportunities for playing, and there are also threats, maybe from perceived competitors. I don't like the word competitors in jazz, rivals, let's put it like that.
Mm.
So you look at all those, and you obviously want to add to the strengths, look out, take care of the weaknesses, exploit the opportunities, and avoid or mitigate the threats.
Mm.
So that's what that is. Now that allows you then to build an action program based on facts and evidence, not on gut feeling or what someone said to you in the jazz club or the pub last night. You know, and it's all got to be based on evidence and research. So there's done a pile of questionnaires, which I'm analysing. So the structure of the report will have the action plan, the analysis, then in the appendices will all be the findings of the questionnaires, plus other stuff as well I'll take from Home Truths and so on. And then that action plan then goes out to the jazz community and they can rip it to shreds. So it's up to them, because at the end of the day they have to own it. So there'll be a consultation and it'll be a bit of a toing and froing. And then when we get the action plan, then people have to, the politicians will have to do their job, hopefully musicians and other people and other organisations can all help. So that's the plan, because plans have a habit of going awry, as we know.
Everyone has a plan until they get punched in the face, as Mike Tyson said.
So, but at least it will be a focal point. And it should hopefully bring the jazz, the whole of the jazz community together in one, hopefully one common endeavour. Might be parts of the jazz community doing it, but at least there'll be a plan there. And also the plan will be how to exploit funding streams. For example, the Arts Council, in one sense, is probably the only game in town, but there are other funding streams. Also, how do you exploit commerce? I mean, sponsorship's always been there. If you've got something that is a big thing, that's going to attract millions of people or thousands of people, then you're going to sponsor. But if you're just a band, how are you going to get anyone to sort of put some money into something? So it's all that needs to be looked at. And find also find ways to help help people, but also people have got to help themselves. So, for example, in terms of the media stuff, everyone's duplicating this. I mean, it just doesn't make sense. Every band will have its own media list, and then people won't share it. So there needs to be a change in the culture and say, look, you want a perfect market. So if you share all this, then you're all going to be competing on the same, hopefully the same
field. Yeah, that's interesting, yeah.
I mean, I think that's one of the things that organisations like Jazz Services gave in the past, which was more a paper age than a computer age, but it gave a career path, is probably the wrong word, but a focus where you could say, well, if I'm going to set my mind to applying for a Jazz Services tour, what do I have to do? And it was a goal which you could achieve or not achieve, but you had a process to go through as a player or a band owner, a runner, whatever, in order to say, well, where can I go with this? I think that's evaporated a bit.
Well, it has, and it's, you know, the Arts Council, its funding schemes are great. And I've received two awards, the actual process itself is not easy.
No.
You know, I can't butter the parsnips on that. And of course, if you organise a tour and you don't get funding, then what do you do? You know, so, but it's there. I think that the problem is there's two levels, up to 15,000 and then over 15,000. I think the Jazz Services one was a lot simpler. But it also meant that if you're going to a Jazz Services tour, you were talking to people that knew about the music. We also provided things like marketing your band. We provided all the media stuff. We did press releases for them and so on. But it's also about self-help. Musicians were able to get on a learning curve. And we were able to support them and help them in that sense.
It does feel like that. I mean, I did do, I think it was through the Musicians Union, Musicians Connect or Connect Musician, I've forgotten, Jazz Connects or something it was called, which is where I came across the SWOT analysis, talking about how to I think it was just that music in general wasn't particularly for jazz, but working out your strengths and weaknesses and all that sort of thing. But that was, to most musicians, that's, I mean, very few colleges teach practical business in terms of music colleges I'm talking about.
It's sort of my bête noire. I wrote when I left Jazz Services, one of the things my list of things to do was to write a business planning manual for music students, and it was called Where Do You Want to Be? So I wrote this thing and I kept it, I'd demystified it, explained everything, it's on my website, and it's free. And I then wrote to 60 music colleges, or music educational establishments, and I got one reply from Simon Purcell. And that was it. And I suddenly thought, this is free. And I was also working on it with Debbie Dickinson, and we were going to offer a training package. And I just thought, what's going on?
Why do you think that is? Why is there that kind of resistance to it? Or is it just not? Is it apathy, really?
No, I think part of it is that, I mean, the government itself, isn't it? I think in their, in terms of conservatoires, it's about turning out, if you like, musicians that can play. And they forget that in this day and age, you need to turn out a musician that has a number of strings to their bow.
Yeah, absolutely.
And one of them is a grasp of business.
Yeah.
Also, if they don't make it on the music scene, they need to have some transferable skill. And it's all very well saying, well, I'm a musician, I'm a great communicator. You and I both know some musicians can communicate their way out of a paper bag, even if you gave them a hand. So I've never understood why there's not been a proper curriculum item, which is business planning for music students, in every music college and conservatory. I mean, there's bits of it. Leeds, I have to say, has a very good, Leeds College of Music has a very good music business.
I know you know Buster Birch, I think he did something at the Academy, but it was just he did a course or something on you know business skills for jazz musicians.
But I think there's a small amount of it.
Yeah, a small amount of it, but it's not coordinated or kind
of. You know, when it comes to music, that's all, that's great, that's all virtually probably the same techniques. When it comes to business education, there's not a curriculum for it. It's not a nationally recognised curriculum like a BTEC thing that says, this is what you have to do, this is what you have to teach them.
And this is how you can prove that you've understood. That, here's the qualification which says you understand marketing or...
But I mean, is it also partly because of the way things have changed very quickly and the way the online... I mean, it seems to me that there isn't kind of one model anymore, is there, of how... You know, there's a lot of different models of how to... become successful as a musician.
Exactly. But if you've got your business plan, your action program, plan, whatever you're doing, so it's like any business. Right? The crucial questions are: where am I now? So that be as a musician, where am I now? Where do I want to be? How am I going to get there? And what do I need to get there? I mean, there are four questions.
And they apply in every situation.
You find if you're running a newsagent or whatever you're doing, and especially music. So it's where am I now? Where do I want to be? Well, hang on a minute. I'm playing this sort of music. Well, maybe I need to be somewhere else. Maybe I need to be able to play to earn a living. Be able to play in a theatre pit. So these four questions are absolutely crucial in anyone's life, career, it doesn't matter if you're a business or an individual. I mean, that's why Brexit drives me absolutely insane. None of them ever sat down and said, well, okay, we've got Brexit, where are we now, where do we want to be, how are we going to get there, what do we need to get there? It's that simple. I mean, it's that simple. And these dunderheads can't even manage that, you know. So, and I think also with this changing world we live in, you know, Brexit's happened, all that sort of stuff. It's, musicians need all the help they can get. So part of that should be training. How do you actually manage this new landscape?
Yeah.
How do you negotiate your way around it? I mean, I know lots of musicians who have luckily have grandparents of European countries. They've all gone and got passports, so that solves that problem. But if you haven't got that, you're apparently on a pretty good wicket. And that should be all part and parcel of it. How do you work in a rapidly changing environment? How do you cope with it? In other words, how do you keep up to date on stuff?
Yeah.
You know, and that's the other crucial thing. It's like Instagram. Now I can do Twitter, I can do Facebook and all that stuff. Instagram, I must admit, sort of drives me crackers, partly because it's so that those pictures only last 2 seconds. Mm. The time I got my reading glasses on, it's gone. So but there's a case in point for me. You know, I should be getting to grips with that. And how do I exploit Instagram, for example? It's posting stuff on.
Yeah.
Okay, that's another thing. How do you use your mobile phone to get decent pictures?
Yeah.
And how do you? Well, hang on. What might grab people's attention? You know, not just slapping up, you know, you having a meal or something, but what would grab people's attention and so on. So, and I think that applies also, that whole concept of lifelong learning applies from right to the bitter end.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, it's that needs to be taught as well, you know. And there is that, you know, that thing that it seems to have gathered pace over the years, that people sort of seem to worship on the altar of youth. And then once you pass 30, unless you've made a big mark, you're in the same pot as everyone else. And if you're lucky, you might come out at 70 as a national treasure. All that whole sort of cultural thing needs to change as well. And the only way you can do that is by some form of business training, some form of lifelong learning, but actually changing the culture. So instead of saying, oh, it's not that important because they didn't teach me at college, you should be saying, it's crucially important. Why aren't you teaching me this? I'm getting a pretty poor deal here because I'm funding it.
Yeah.
And that's the bit that gets me, is they should be shouting from the rooftops. It's not good enough. You know?
I think with music, and perhaps with other things which are technically very difficult to master, a lot of people's work is kind of just trying to acquire the practical skills of music. Well, and the side, as far as we as musicians are sometimes concerned, the side issues of, you know, I mean, I for example, you're talking about Instagram. Well, I've just opened a TikTok account, having not wanted to bother with it.
Yeah.
Because isn't it just another Instagram? Yeah. Well, actually, it isn't another Instagram. And unfortunately, with the way in which things change, when Instagram started, for example, it was Polaroids on your phone. That was that was how it was set up. And it was mostly people who actually liked photography and took photos. But now Instagram, partly because it's been bought by Facebook, but partly also because things change, it's now half TikTok, half something else. And everything is fluid in that respect. And I think what it can seem like all of that's rather unimportant if you're a musician, but self-promotion and promoting your band and looking for outlets, the digital technology allows you to do that much more quickly, but also you do have to actually do it well, because there's 90% of TikTok, 90% of Instagram is dross.
Yeah, well, this is the whole point about the training. It's how do you exploit all this new technology, and that's it. How do you do it well? You know, it's that whole concept of right first time. And obviously for younger people, they're immersed in it, so it's going to be a lot easier. And some obviously just take to it like a duck to water. They wouldn't need a training session on it. They can just...
They make it in a way. Some people make these platforms, don't they?
And they find their way through. You know, it's. I mean, I first got to grips with computing and so on. So I said, I'll throw the manual out the window. Half of them were all wrong anyway.
Mm.
Just do it by trial and error.
Yeah, find your own way.
And yeah. That way you're going to learn.
Mm.
And so I did all that, and it was a lot easier than the manual. And I actually, Google is incredible. Because you can type a certain question and you get an answer out.
Yeah.
But all these skills, and I think this is the whole thing, it's in, helping people to understand that they can do that now, but then watch around the corner.
Yeah.
What's over the horizon?
Mm, what's coming?
What's the next thing that I've got to wrestle?
And it's being flexible, isn't it, as well? Yeah. Being open to... I mean, I think, there is a tendency amongst musicians of a certain age to complain about how things aren't as good as they used to be, I always sort of think, well, the opportunities are still there, but it's just different. You need different skills. It's different, it's not... You know, it's not like the 60s where there were studio sessions, and it's completely different now.
The whole thing's changed, and it's always. I mean, for example, if you went back to 1930, and then you got to 1945, you'd find exactly the same thing.
Mm.
Except it just seems it's more rapid.
Mm. Yeah.
That whole digital thing.
Yes.
Is like a sort of explosion that just keeps.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like a reaction.
And I suppose part of it is also figuring out what is useful for you and what maybe not everything is useful. But what can actually serve you. It's kind of sorting your way through it all.
Well, it is, I do Twitter and all that sort of stuff, and I think Facebook, and I just sort of. Learn by a bit of a laggard, I suppose. But at least I master it and I do it. I think, this is useful. I can I do a post on my website, and I can Facebook it and I can tweet it.
Mm-hmm.
All this sort of stuff.
Yes, it's about funnels. Talk about funnels these days.
It's also having you're quite an action plan rather than a business plan, an action program. You need also to have some sort of quantified objective.
Mm.
And it's also trying to teach people there's nothing wrong with a target for the government or that, but you as an individual, that helps you get there.
Mm.
Where do you want to be, where do you want to get? So, my target was to reach 10,000 through MailChimp, Facebook, LinkedIn, and Twitter.
Mm.
And I've exceeded that. So the next target was 15,000. So I've started to look at 20,000. And there's only so much you can do in a day, but it's all these sorts of things. At least you're conscious of, right, how can I build that? Because the more contacts you build, the more networks you do. And it's a bit like some people say, I never follow anyone on Twitter. You just think, of course you should, because you build your people follow you and you follow people, all of a sudden you haven't got 100,
And there's also the interesting edge, the concept of the edge of those things. So you're a trumpeter. If you only follow trumpeters, you'd know loads of trumpeters. And you'd see how people were gigging, and you might get fear of missing out, and as FOMO, as they call it, all those sorts of things. But if you follow pianists as well, they're not a direct threat in the SWAT argument. In fact, there could be an ally because you might get a gig from them. And it's like the same with, say, film music. You need to follow editors, producers, directors.
Mm.
Don't follow other composers as much. I mean, do, but don't only follow other composers, because all you'll do is see what everyone else is doing. Whereas if you follow people on the edge of your craft, you can also...
Well, exactly. Mm. And also, it's sort of, if people follow me, I just think, it's a courtesy, I'll follow them.
Mm.
I sometimes check some of them, because if one of them follows me, but they're hyper religious, then I tend not to. I'm sorry, but I just
there are a lot of bots out there too, where accounts turn up and they sort of follow you and say follow me back, and in fact they don't really exist. It's just a way of garnering, proliferating influence in a way. Which isn't actually, because it's an interesting thing with all these digital technologies. You find people who say we'll get you 100,000 followers by the end of the month. It's like, do I want a 20-year-old typist who really likes going to Ibiza to follow my jazz feed? Is she going to like what I do? And ever come to a gig? Probably not.
Yeah. Well, that's it. I mean, if people follow me, I mean, I follow them, I usually check them out quickly because you just do it. You just press it, have a look, and think, oh, they're okay. Mm. Well, that could be useful.
Mm.
That could be. And also, as you say, it's not just trumpet players. It's any musician, really. And it could be a media outlet that follows you, and so you follow them back and so on. So it's a fascinating world, but of course it's, and as you get older, it becomes not so much harder. You just have to wrestle with it and just get to grips with it. And if you don't, it's not that you're lost, but you're missing a trick. You know, people say, oh, I don't bother with that. I say, well, hang on a minute, you could get an extra 10 people to your gig. And that's the difference. Makes it.
And in a jazz gig, that's a quarter of the audience.
So it's, and that to me is crucially important. And this research coming out for Review of Jazz that will be showing up, for example, our musicians are members of PPL and the MU and so on and so on, and members of PRS. And, you know, one would expect 100% should be members of PPL, but that's not the case. I've got the figures to hand.
Do you know, when I tried to join the PPL, and for some reason there was something it wouldn't do, it wouldn't let me join. So, well, you know, I got website fatigue in the end, but it just wouldn't let me progress through the form for some reason. I can't remember what the reason was.
No, you should be able to.
I mean, I'm a member of the PRS and have been for years, but I did attempt to join PPL.
No, you should be able to join it. I mean, it's all changed. I mean, over the years, when Fran Levka got there, he did a huge amount of work, and now Peter Leatham's carried on. If there's a problem, there's someone there that'll actually sort it out for you, and quickly as well. I mean, I've had a problem, you know, filling in the data and all this sort of stuff. And I've emailed them, and the next day I've got a really helpful response saying, look, you can pop in and call us, we can do it from the phone, we can do it on a Zoom thing. So I'm sure it's one of those things
where someone said, oh, you should do that. I thought, oh, I'll just do that in half an hour, and three quarters of an hour later I'm tearing my hair out thinking, I'll do it another day.
No, if you're on the albums or whatever, you're going to pick up performers royalties.
Yes, well, it's more, I mean, it's more the film sort of conducting and film sessions and things,
That sort of leads us on to, I suppose, the last question that we had was, how do you see, you know, how do you see the sort of the future of UK jazz? I mean, it's a huge question, but just, I mean, we've been talking a little bit about some of the kind of recent developments and how, you know, musicians might be able to, I suppose, harness those. But just more generally, you know, how, I mean, obviously we've just come out of this very, very difficult period with the lockdown, which had a big impact on the jazz scene, I think, in terms of venues. But, I mean, just how do you sort of see the future? Are you kind of positive about the future of UK jazz?
Well, I'm one of life's optimists. And the glass is never half empty. It's usually so full it's spilling over down my shirt front and ruining my tie. You know? I think the great thing is the music always takes care of itself. That's the one thing you don't have. I mean, you look at the explosion of young players now, the diversity, and the influences.
It's incredibly healthy.
In a sense, reshaping the scene, using all the digital media stuff. It's to be applauded. It's great, and everyone should learn from it. People can learn from it. So it's not a problem with the music. I think the problem is the infrastructure. And now we've got Brexit, there's no, and it's there, it's not going to go away. How do people negotiate that? And you get a government that talks of global Britain, but there's no, I see no no action plan from them to help make it global Britain. And surely one of the things you'd be using, if you're a government with half an ounce of senses, how do you exploit soft power? And soft power is the music business. It's the British Council.
Mm.
The music business and so on. So I think that's, the music's not the problem.
Mm.
It's how do we develop the infrastructure, and how do we get the government to sort of, if they're going to think of a global Britain, then they ought to be using the things that really do make Britain global, which is its music, the arts, theatre, all the opera companies are touring around the world and so on. And jazz is a fantastic vehicle for that. And so that's the problem.
Mm.
That's what's got to be somehow achieved.
Mm.
And how do we help musicians get over these hurdles of touring Europe, for example?
Yeah.
I mean, someone once said to me, through, I can't remember, a government-funded organisation, I'll say it was the Arts Council, actually said to me, Jazz Services, you should be looking at hot spots around the world for putting, you know, British musicians. I just couldn't believe it. I said, what you want me to get a band to do a tour of volcanoes? I said, it's just risible. It's China. I said, who wants to go to China? We've got no copyright rights whatsoever. The markets are Europe, and expanding Europe, and North America.
Mm. Mm.
If you're a musician, where are you going to make your living? Now, of course, if you were going back 20, 30, 40 years ago, you might also make a living in New Zealand and Australia doing touring and so on, if you've been on BBC television and so forth. But for musicians, the big markets are Europe and North America.
Mm.
Where else? The rest is great, that's icing on the cake.
Mm.
So we do need to say, how can we crack these markets?
Mm.
How can we help musicians get there? From there, then they can also then go to all the other places, because they build their, you know, Japan and so on, they build their track records, and they build their profile.
Japan is big on jazz, isn't it?
It'd
be interesting to see if China ever does get into jazz.
Well, bands have to, I mean, Stan Tracy toured there, and bands have obviously worked there, mainly in Hong Kong, but also in Shanghai, I think they worked.
Mm.
But also, it's not just Japan, it's Korea.
Mm.
So that's a whole other marketplace, you know, Japan, Korea, Australia, and so forth. So, but all that needs analysing, but it needs a government to say, hang on a minute, we've got funding for this.
Mm.
And then how do you distribute the funding, and in what way, and how do you make it easy for people to access the funding? And sometimes, you know, if it's not just funding to get abroad, it's actually to get you abroad.
Mm.
So you might need to say, well, I actually need funding to research the whole marketplace and so forth. And jazz needs an action plan for that.
Mm.
And hopefully this review of jazz will supply something of that.
Mm. When's that due to be published?
Good point. I'm working like a stinker. I'm trying to get it out by October or November. The problem is I'm working on some other projects for touring, and the Circus Act with the spinning plates.
Yes.
and some of the spinning plates are just falling off the...
So,
but I'm really just going to work like stink to get it out of the way, and then get some action on it. Also, it's interesting that now you've got, if you like, a new government coming in. There'll be the election in
2024.
So. Probably now, you know, so this is coming out at actually the right time.
Yeah, yeah.
So whoever wins that election will be in a position to utilise the information.
Well, it'll be published. Well, what I'm going to do is obviously it'll go out for consultation right, left and centre. There'll probably be a couple of public meetings. And it's a case of getting everyone to look at it and say, that's doable, don't like that. You know, they've got to own it. So if it gets shot down in flames, that's not a problem for me, as long as
Something comes out of it.
They put something in its place.
Yeah, exactly.
You know what it's like in just in life. There's always the critic, isn't there?
Yeah.
But they never actually say, oh, that's wrong. And you say, what are you going to do about it? Mm. Because they haven't got a clue.
Mm. Yeah. No, it's easy to criticise.
Yeah, so what you want is people to say, well, actually, you're on the right track, but I think this could be done better. Mm. That's what I want. Mm. And good idea, but why not do it this way?
Mm.
You know.
And if people, is this your web? Is the web your website the best place for people to kind of?
No, if they go to the www.appjag.org, they'll see the review of Jazz.
Okay,
on there.
We'll probably put that at Trump. That's a link.
We'll put that in as a link.
Yeah, that'd be great. And also, if people, I've got a what I did do was when I left Jazz Services. And then I got called in to wind it up when they lost their funding to close the office down. And so I managed to save all the board papers and all the files, went off to Westminster University and so on. And I also saved the business, online music business resource, which is now on my website.
Okay.
Oh, that's so useful. Mark Ibban is on there. Some stuff there which is obviously out of date, but that's archived, but still available.
Mm.
And the research papers, the papers I've written, all this sort of stuff.
Yeah, well, we'll put a link to your website as well.
With PPL and PRS, we're about to, once the review comes out, they want to time it, but when the review comes out, there'll be a manual on the copyright with PPL and produced by PPL and PRS. And it's obviously a digital online thing that can always be updated.
Mm.
I mean, that's a beauty.
Mm.
If you print something, you can't.
Yeah, sure.
You know, if it's a first edition, you might be able to sell it if you know what you're doing. But after that, it's so the digital thing means that can be permanently updated.
Yeah.
So that'll be hopefully on the PPL website and so on. And of course, it'll be for everybody. It's not just Jazz, but I mean, these are basic rules.
Sure.
The copyright thing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And how do you exploit your own copyright the nicest possible sort of way and all this sort of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But there are, you know, problems. Spotify, for example.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, there's a book that's come out by Will Page, who was an economist at PRS and Spotify, called Tarzan Economics. And it's very well written. And it's got a lot of good stuff in there. But it really doesn't take account of the fact that if you're a jazz musician, you're not going to even get a, you know, even not even get a cheese sandwich out of it.
No.
You'd be lucky to get a cheese sandwich.
Mm.
And no matter how hard you try and push your music forward,
not going to work.
There's all sorts of things going. They got playlists. If you're a symphony orchestra, now you've got a piece of music on there that might be 10 minutes long. Well, the usual bit for a bit of money is 30 seconds, isn't it?
Mm.
But you've got 10 minutes of music of symphony orchestra, and they're going to earn the same money you get for 30 seconds.
Mm.
It's just miserable. Yeah, I mean, it just doesn't work the same if you're a big band with an extensive
thing. Yeah,
so there are all these sorts of problems and issues that also have to be resolved.
Mm.
On that note, thank you very much.
No, thank you.
Yes, for being with us, and that's goodbye from me, Simon Whiteside.
Yeah, and goodbye from me next time.